become more, I'd say, more acutely aware lately of, don't quite know how the best way to phrase it, but let's say the part of me that doesn't want to be awakened. Like, I've been acutely aware of my desire to be awakened or unplugged or enlightened or whatever, you know, the terminology I had it in from my early 20s to date. Basically, my whole life has been driven towards this goal, supposedly. I mean, consciously. Doesn't mean I've actually been moving towards it, as we know. But so lately, I have become more aware of a part of me that actually is saying, well, actually, I'm not sure I do want to get awakened or whatever, because I actually quite enjoy things the way they are. I'm not sure where I'm going with that, but I think it's an interesting development, because I think it's more honest, for one thing. And I mean, you've talked about, well, maybe you haven't talked about, but you've made me aware of, anyway, a certain fear of responsibility that comes with awakening. And certainly the idea, I have the idea, and I don't think it's just an idea either, that becoming fully who we are does entail letting go of living for one's own desires and, you know, comforts and satisfactions.
No, that's old language. That's religious language. It's not really exactly that. Certainly, but we all do it anyway. It's not really like a huge martyrdom thing. We all give up our comfort. We all compromise, but some of us give up our comfort for things that we love, and some of us give up our comfort for things that we hate. I'm working for things that I love, and I compromise and I sacrifice. Other people, they work for things that they don't really want to be involved in, but they feel they have to for their survival, and they also sacrifice. The sacrifice, the real sacrifice, is sacrifice in the sense of just giving something up. What a person has to give up if they really want their life back is they have to give up the old fake life. Can't have two mm-hmm. living in the same house. They will fight. And that's mm-hmm. really everyone's problem, who's having inner suffering. There's external suffering that can be imposed upon a person, but the inner suffering is where there's a civil war using up a person's resources, their energy, their awareness, their processing time, making them a Jekyll and Hyde in their relationships. They're inconsistent because of a civil war where one puppet regime comes in, then your real self comes through and you're a nice guy, then you're other character, Mr. Punch, comes through, and now you're not a nice guy, and people can't figure out who you are because you've got these various characters going on inside you. Then you have remorse, then you have guilt, then you wonder, are you really in control? Then you do penance, then you do spiritual practices, and that whole industry starts just because people are divided with inside themselves.
Yeah, that was where I was going to go also, that the thing that I'm aware that I would have to give up, that I don't want to give up because I enjoy it. Like, it's most concretely tangible to me, tautological there, through as movies, my addiction to movies and TV, yeah. Right? And I know that's a small thing. Like, it's sort of paradoxical.
No, it's not a small thing. It's not anything that gets your desire is not a small thing. We're not talking about what sounds like a small thing. Something that gets your desire is a huge thing. Obviously, beneath the level of the iceberg, there's a whole load of associations with pleasure or fantasy or escapism. There's all kinds of promised Valhallas or Shangri-Las associated with the persona that you were working on. And letting, you know, unprising your fingers from all of those things that you hope to of God can be a slow process. And it just came to my mind that one of the hardest things for me to have to relinquish, and this was after enlightenment, I still nursed the fantasy, which I never revisited. And I had written a movie script myself, not a full one.
Mm-hmm.
And if that script had ever got produced, I'm not saying that it ever would have, it would have got me in a whole load of trouble.
How come?
Because it was tackling fundamentalism. And I'm not going to say which type of fundamentalism. I won't even go near it, right? But the thing is that I would have invested a lot of time and energy in it. I would have thought this would have really helped people and changed it. But after I got enlightened, I knew what would really help people. And it wouldn't have been something that would appear on BBC for 6 episodes and then disappear forever.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't create permanent change. That might create a few questions in people's minds. I also knew it really wasn't what I now wanted to deliver to people. That script was, in a sense, an exploration of pleasure-seeking on the one hand and austerity and chasing after a dream of heaven on the other hand. It was a clash of cultures. And that might make some people think, but it's not necessarily going to change people. I had a better message after that. After I got enlightened, I had something much more important to deliver, something that really is recognizing that it's a life and death thing whether someone wakes up in this moment or not, and eventually getting something on TV if that ever happened, and probably making no money from it and then having to make more scripts if successful to be able to start making money. That was a fruitless path. I preferred just to offer to people what I had. So that, but I had it in my back of my mind because it was such an interesting script for me. It was such a night, but I couldn't go near it. I couldn't touch it. I knew that I was involved in something much more valuable, important, powerful, essential, and necessary than that. So no matter how titillating that script was, titillation wasn't for me anymore.
Hmm. Did you keep the script?
Oh, I pretty much have everything in storage somewhere, but it's definitely not on display. So like, it's not accessible to me easily now.
Did you have a religious upbringing?
No. Not really. I mean, I got exposed to little bits of religion here and there. School, right? Religious assembly, that was the rigueur in schools when I was growing up. So certainly there was exposure to religion, and I definitely was exposed to religion, but I didn't have my parents strongly leading me in religious life or religious practices. There was just a little bit around.
So how was your day?
A beloved tomato soup and a grilled cheese sandwich warm the tummy on a cold gray day.
So how was your day?
A beloved tomato soup and a grilled cheese sandwich warm the tummy on a cold gray day.
No, we were talking about talking, which is actually what the Limitless podcast often gets to, is let's talk about talking. You know, what happens when two people converse, and the experience I've become more aware of relating to people, which is something that you're focusing on more now. Like that's where the real gold is in interrelation with people. And experience I've become more aware of, I would say, in recent months and years is how, and I said this on the last retreat to somebody, I don't remember who, that when I'm interacting with someone and conversing with someone, there's an almost visceral sense of, well, I described it this way, and I think it was inadequate, that there's a sort of void or a vacuum in this other person that is pulling, drawing something out of me, and that it's coming out through the expression, not just through the words, but the words are definitely central to it. And it's a very, very satisfying experience. Why I love really good conversations, it's the feeling that my soul is actually coming into manifestation as a response to the need or the requirement of another soul that is right in front of me. And I'm getting tingles talking about it. But the insight I had was that with you, there isn't that vacuum. And I don't know if this is true or not, but definitely my experience with you is it's difficult for me to find my words. And I thought, and I've, you know, I was wondering, why is that? Is it, you know, I won't go into all the different specifics, but definitely I was wondering why. So it just occurred to me that actually that might be part of why, is that with you I don't really experience any kind of need coming from you that I'm thereby responding to.
Well, we have good conversations, don't we?
We do, but I'd say it's harder for me to really be myself with you than with other people, which is ironic because I feel that you see me more clearly than just about anyone.
Okay, well, you know, that's maybe what's going on in your department, on your side of the court, because, of course, I'm not trying to have you not be yourself. So whether you're being yourself, maybe, I don't know, this word that you're being yourself, sometimes it, when a person says it, they're not really being themselves, they just mean that they're not
being so self-conscious. Well, I'm more self-conscious with you.
Yeah, they're not being so self-conscious. Yeah, I think I'm more... But sometimes self-consciousness actually isn't simply inhibition, it's actually being aware. This came up when I was talking to someone earlier today. The question was really, are they just being aware more of their tensions, of their holding back? I'm sure that when I look at people, they probably feel that their general demeanor and persona goes unnoticed, that they've got tensions, that they've got inhibitions, that they lack confidence, that they're talking from a script and they're behaving from a script, that repetitive gestures and mannerisms. Well, I'm noticing all of that. If they know that I'm seeing all of that, they definitely will get self-conscious. Now, I'm not saying that exactly that's going on in your case. I'm just saying there's a number of possibilities there. But from my side, what I would say is, I mean, just to give you some information, we have some interesting conversations and we seem to be picking with our chopsticks out of the same hot pot. Right? So we seem to arrive at the same ideas at about the same time. And if, for example, you know that I drop something in the hot pot and it's my thing, it's not yours, you might push it over towards me, right, to my side of the hot pot bowl, and I might see something in there and I go, well, you know, that's Jason's thing, that's not mine, I have no interest in that, and I'm sure he's getting quite hungry for it, I'll push it over to his side of the hot pot bowl. And so what I'm pointing to is that it's not exactly like need. I'm not like looking at you and going, my God, he looks so emaciated, I better make sure that I drop a whole load of food in here and make sure he can stuff it in his face as soon as possible. It's not that kind of a need. But nonetheless, there is a more delicate, more subtle, more refined kind of a need. It's not like an emotional need, but it's more like an undramatic exploration of things. So what happens with some people is they have very strong emotional issues going on and they need help in that area, and by helping them in that area, the real payoff is that they become more conscious, aware and energized. It's not about their emotions. It's just about that they're going to recover more of themselves. So that kind of thing is not really going to be going on with me, because I'm not losing myself and I'm not going to anyone trying to find myself. That's what I used to do. That's not going on with me. But not being caught up in all of that emotional stuff enables investigation. It enables us to calmly assess things and to kick ideas around, and you know, we can be irreverent, we can make ridiculous surreal jokes, and it's all really in service not of being smart arses, but it's about facilitating free association, which is in turn facilitating uncovering things that are like on the tip of our tongue or on the periphery of our mental space. So there is what I wanted to point to is that there's an exchange going on, but you're right, it's of a different order to the exchange that can go on with you with someone else who is looking for certain other qualities in life and that I am looking for, and you may be able to fulfill some of those things that they're looking for in some way or another. Doesn't necessarily mean that you directly fulfill them. You know, if they're looking for a father figure, I don't think you're going to do that for them, but you may help them rise above that need or resolve it or find fulfillment elsewhere, for example. Not for me to say exactly what you're doing with people, but I'm actually speculating that it might be something that I know of myself.
Right. You know, it occurs to me that, yeah, there is another element there, which is that if I feel the person somehow needs something from me, although I think we could unpack that word need, but then that's a kind of comfort zone for me. Like, I feel confident in that role as somebody who's, you know, responding to somebody else's need. So with you, yeah, there's a certain amount of discomfort there that relates to me not quite knowing what's expected of me or what's required of me, and therefore I can't fall back on familiar, you know, methodologies, right, and approaches. Right. So it's interesting to do this podcast with you because there is more. I do feel like I'm more, well, it's certainly more of a familiar role for me to be in, but also that, like, I'm partly doing this for you.
Yeah.
So there is,
you know, I'm supporting this podcast by not being too iconoclastic, irreverent, and pulling the rug from underneath everything all of the time. You know, I could do that too. You know, but we're, so I just, as a meta comment, what we're doing is we're chewing through concepts that ostensibly will be useful and will strike a chord, hopefully, for some of your listeners.
So, how was your day? I'm allowed to make a stupid grilled cheese sandwich or the dynamic cold bread. So, how was your day?
The human mind is dark, but in our hearts there is a spark. And I'm certain there is going to come a day when we've turned out all the lights and the robots work at night, and we've saved ourselves the trouble of decay. But I think I understand.
Well, I appreciate the lack of jokes, actually, now that you mention it, and not because I don't enjoy your jokes, but I enjoy them quite passively, and it's definitely not my forte, sort of, you know, repartee or jokey repartee, I wouldn't say. But let's bring it back to the ancestors, because I felt like we didn't get all the way into this experience I had, because I saw you nodding, and it seemed like you it was somehow, it was to some degree matching your own experience, of when I'm with another person, or when you are, there's a sense that there's something we have to deliver, to share. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have a real sense, and I haven't tried to really analyze where that's coming from or how I know it, because how I find out is what I'm delivering. I just say, oh, okay, so that was what I had to deliver. I have no idea how that works, except in these very simple terms that the soul thrives on contact with other souls, and so souls bring each other out. That's as far as I go with that. You have this much larger context of the ancestors, and that you've described that they give you packages to deliver to people that you encounter. So this is an example of quite profound esoteric knowledge that well, it's quite hard to verify, but you've obviously decided it's necessary to share and to make it part of your teaching. So why do you think it's necessary to have this understanding of the ancestors?
It wasn't, first of all, the first thing that I've ever shared in my teaching life. It wasn't early on. It wasn't something that I thought about. It wasn't something that I was ever interested in either. And when I started having experiences of people's ancestors or family members, departed family members coming to me, it still wasn't something I brought into the teaching. And it's not my go-to answer for when a person comes to me with a problem. It's not like the first thing that I reach for. It's more like the last thing that I'm going to reach for as a consideration. And quite often, I'm not going to reach for something as a consideration unless I start to experience something around it. Yeah. So the ancestors thing started with me, for example, being in a foreign country, being in a car with people I didn't really know very well, squashed between them, and then turning to one person and saying, is this name a name in your country? And then getting all this feeling about it and a story associated with it and something like that. And then not quite getting the name exactly right, but then the person being quite surprised and finding out there's a tragic story associated with it. And that's what I'm picking up, and that's what I'm feeling, and I'm picking up some other things, who that person's parents are or family or something like that. I'm picking up stuff about it. So that stuff has come to me unbidden. I don't go looking for it. I don't actually go looking for anything. The things that come to me, what I understand about people, I don't go looking for it. But if someone says to me, oh, what about my ancestors? Or if for some reason I go, well, you know, like, this doesn't seem to be your mind, it doesn't seem to be your diet, and it doesn't seem to be your environment, it doesn't seem to be your upbringing, then eventually I'll go through a checklist of things, and the ancestors will be low down on the list to consider. And then I might tune into something. The other thing is that when I'm on retreats, I feel that there are messages for me to give to people. I feel that it comes with a lot of love, it comes with a lot of interest and a lot of concern, and it wakes me up in the night. Now, there could be other explanations for that, certainly, but nonetheless, these are my experiences. I'm experiencing things, and they seem to be highly relevant to the people, and some of them seem to be verifiable by people. I mean, obviously, sometimes I'm not getting any kind of information that would mean much or could be verified.
Hmm.
But I have this love-hate relationship with this kind of thing happening to me. I don't like it. It's an intrusion. But if I feel something coming through me and I feel that I'm supposed to deliver it to someone else, I don't see it as my business to dam it up or to block it. And it's cruel as well. I mean, let's say, for example, we were living in an apartment block and I happened to get your post come through my letterbox. I think, tough luck, sucker. You know, it got misdelivered. I'm not walking it up the stairs to your apartment. I mean, that's just not very civic-minded, is it? So the thing is that if things come to me that are for someone else, I don't have to say it's your ancestor. I'm just acting on information anonymously given to me. You know, this person needs a care package for Christmas. Okay, I'll deliver it outside their house. I'm just acting on it. I don't have to go into what my idea is or what my perception of what's going on is. I don't have to do that. So I don't necessarily like this stuff coming through. I don't want the feeling of someone's ancestors always coming through. I'm even starting to question, because it isn't happening strongly at the moment, these days, I'm even starting to question, of course, that what comes through, it's not necessarily the purest guidance. The fact is, your parents love you, and we can take that to the bank. Maybe how they treated you and how they didn't treat you and where they were absent and what they didn't pay attention to, we can't take that to the bank. So someone's ancestors coming through, it's a very mixed package. The love, that's real. But anything else that they want, I have to say, may be true, it may not be true. So it's not like the most pure information coming through. And there could be alternative ideas about where this comes from, for example. I mean, I think something you've wondered about me is, where do I pick information up from? Am I reading you, for example? But certainly if I look at you, then, you know, I am looking at your parents as well. They are embodied in you in a variety of ways. DNA, although I don't see DNA really. The physical structure of you is there. Your gestures, your mannerisms, your accent, your way of thinking, your reactions to things. There's all kinds of things that speak of your parents and your parents alone. I mean, it's amazing. I don't know if you've ever had this experience. You can phone someone, and their brother, their sister, their mother, their father picks up the phone, not the father so much, maybe later on in life, and you're like, you think that you're talking to your friend, and then you realize, well, I'm not. I'm actually talking to one of their family members. They all seem to have the same voice, only in that household. You don't hear it anywhere else. That's how much the individual differences are, how many individual differences exist, and that's how it is like passed on down through a family line. So I'm open to other interpretations. I was very surprised when certain things come to me, but I've learned to say what comes to me, because invariably it's highly relevant to that person. But I don't want to create mysticism. I don't want to create esoteric concepts really, but I'm sitting on a whole load of information, and I'm not being forthcoming if I don't talk about it.
She comes out of nowhere and leaves while I sleep. I haven't left this room in nearly 2 weeks. Little specks of dust that sparkle in the sun make it hard to breathe. It's like breathing in someone. I can hear my heart beat
there's no telling which way these walls might fall. Perfectly outrageous claims about my aim challenge my existence and tell me I'm to blame.
Worth questioning what constitutes esoteric, what constitutes mystical, because I mean we have a consensus about what's real and what's empirical and what's provable and all the rest of it, but that's really based on an agreement. Well, various different agreements, but one being what's the criteria by which we determine what's real and so on. Right, and not to get too abstract, but what you're describing there with the ancestors and what have you, I mean, A, it's your experience, so you want to represent it, you want to include it in your communication just because it's part of your experience. But B, it seems to me that, I mean, I was just talking in the podcast before this one with this guy Gibb, and he has an interest in this question in terms of how he describes it, is that when we were born in the middle of our parents' story, and then we started our story and so on, and if we have kids, well, they'll be born in the middle
That's
of our
right.
story. So it's like you can try and trace your story back to the beginning, but you'll end up in the middle of someone else's story and so on. So the really, and that would just go on, that would just keep going on and on, and that and certainly in terms of how we relate to ourselves as stories and how we just see existence as a story or a narrative, then it would actually be more accurate, in a certain sense, less esoteric, really, less mystical, to allow the ancestors, and like you're also saying...
Absolutely, because you see, what people normally do is, it's like they've got amnesia or short-term memories, or they can't see beyond their own nose. People think of themselves as individuals. Well, this is like a brain cell declaring independence. In fact, why not have all your brain cells declare independence and become autonomous regions? Then you won't have a brain, then you won't have a body, and nothing will survive, right? But a neuron, presumably, if it could become sentient all by itself, it could say, look, you know, I'm just not going along with the group thing. The thing is that the interconnectedness that we are, which happens in many different ways and on many different levels, is not really being recognized. If we were in the same room right now, we would be affecting each other in ways that we wouldn't think about, but science has even discovered already. I mean, you know, we've got smells going through the air, hormones that affect each other, sweat that's moving around, farting, burping, fidgeting, convection currents, heat, making all kinds of guttural and gestural sounds that are going to have an influence on each other. Then it's like mushrooms in the forest. We think those mushrooms are separate, but they're growing on a ring that's underneath the ground. So just because people see independent entities of human beings and are taught to think of themselves as independent, in some cultures, not in other ones. In other cultures, there's a group mind. There's a working together. People are more like worker bees. They're in synchronization. There's a murmuration effect. We are really aware of each other. And when we move on Oxford Street, we're all moving around each other. We all know where each other is, and we generally don't walk into someone else. But we think of myself, you know, me. And of course, sure, you've got to make sure that you don't bump into anyone and that no one bumps into you, but there's a traffic flow system where we're all communicating to each other, hey, don't cross my path, or if you do, I'll get out the way, and or you'll get out of my way, depending on whether you're high or low status. There's a lot going on there just in walking down a busy street. We're not independent. We can't survive by ourselves. We're constantly signaling and noticing what's going on with other people. But because we're physically discrete bodies, we think that we're separate. But the thing is that the blood, the cells, the skin, the tissue, the bones in your body all grew out of Eve. Not Adam, Eve. It all grew out of your mum. You are just not simply offspring. You're a divided cell from your mother's body. You're more your mother than you are your father.
Yeah, it's the spark that comes from the father, so I guess it has a special whatever charge.
I don't know if it's the spark. I don't know. So what does that make? What does that make the egg?
Well, it's like the seed and the earth, I suppose. Yeah. The earth grows the plant, but without the seed, nothing comes out.
Absolutely, both are needed. We can use all kinds of metaphors, but anyway, it's two things coming together. But the thing is that, the main growth happens in the mother's body. The main incubation, the main communion, the feeding, the waste taking out, the care, the carrying, the transportation, that's all happening in the mother's body.
Yeah, it's certainly something few of us think about, I think, is that we were actually created out of our mother's body. And
most people haven't seen, here, of course, people, they go to a whole family will go to sauna together, but most people haven't seen their mum or their father naked. Or like just as a matter of course. Unless they're alcoholics.
I was casting my mind back there. Yeah,
I know. Yeah. It wasn't very difficult.
Because in the Bible, you're not supposed. I mean, seeing Noah naked is a really bad thing.
The problem was that they covered up his nakedness. That's the issue.
No, it wasn't. It was the Sheb or whichever one who covered him up.
They walked backwards with a blanket.
But the other one.
Okay, well, it's a different. A different interpretation is that they were embarrassed. That's why they walked backwards and covered him up, because they were embarrassed.
That's true. But one of them actually saw him naked, and he was somehow cursed because of it.
Yeah, we don't know why.
Because he looked. Rather than the others did it right, they walked backwards and they respected their father enough.
I have to go back and read that, because our Bible interpretations vary, but I had to go back and have a look at that. My understanding was that they thought it was so embarrassing, in a sense, the embarrassment that was there in the Garden of Eden, the shame, the shock, whatever it was, covering up the genitalia with the fig leaf, was being reenacted again in this new heaven and new earth, where this original sin and whatever was associated with covering up the fig leaf wasn't being reenacted. But anyway, I'd have to go back to it, which I don't have the time and energy to do that much.
I'll probably remember, but
anyway, you're quite good. You're quite good with your literary analysis, except for with some of the things that you pick up sometimes. Someone else's theory about history. We won't go into some of them, but anyway.
Well, we might. I was seeing a sort of chain of association there. I mean, really, there's a lot of different ways we go there with this ancestral line. And the collective, the group mind and the group body, like we're all physically connected, is something I realized recently, even though it's totally obvious. Like you and I are physically connected because we're sitting on the same earth, right?
Absolutely.
The objects that we're connected to are connected to objects are connected to each other.
That's right. So, not just objects, but gases, airs, planets, stars, vibrations, convections. There's lots and lots of different connections going on. And now we're having electrical one. There's an electrical one, you know. There's a very, very fast speed. Electrical connections are going from, you know, from here to there and from there to here. It's traversing the world.
It's back to the Matrix again. It's almost like we're unconsciously trying to recreate the womb and the mother's body through electronic means. And I know that's a very
I don't know about that
idea, really? But
maybe.
Well, I'll finish where I was going because it just came to me. Yeah. So yeah, obviously it's a big thing to just introduce out of nowhere. But because you were talking about how when people when you walk down Oxford Street, which of course I've done, and yes, it's a particularly busy street. And one of the things I really, because I don't like crowds, so I expect you don't either. So if I have to walk down Oxford Street, the thing that I try to do is to make it as quick as possible. So I basically walk as fast as I can. And that requires quite a good skill set for navigating human beings. So it's very like being in really heavy traffic. It is traffic, human traffic. And, you know, I try and gauge as well as I can with all my senses. I'm not really doing it consciously. All I'm consciously doing is trying to get to the end of Oxford Street as quick as possible without bumping into anyone, but moving unreasonably fast, you know, really dodging and ducking.
We don't have to go down Oxford Street. You don't have to go down Oxford. You just take the back streets. You'll get there a little bit slower, but you won't have to bump into
people.
No,
but there is
people.
Part of me that enjoys this, I think, is what I'm saying. I enjoy that because it is an experience of being in the crowd, and actually I am
intimacy.
Experiencing my and the interconnectivity of all of us by, in a sort of negative way, like trying to move through it without actually, you know, having it impinge upon me too much. But anyway, it occurred to me that now more and more, if you go down Oxford Street, people will be looking at their mobiles or their smartphones, which would make it easier. They'll be moving slightly more slowly.
When someone's not looking, they're more likely to bump into you, though. You might be able to navigate around them, but they would do like ridiculously uncoordinated things without looking and could easily walk backwards into you and things like that, or you're walking and you don't realize someone suddenly stops, because the most precious thing is the text message that they just received, rather than figuring out that their physical safety is paramount. Their phone is now taken over.
It's true. Well, if they did bump into you though, they probably wouldn't really hardly notice it anyway.
No, if you knocked them over, they would notice it. Not if their phone flew out of their hand, they're definitely like going to a panic attack based upon what you just said.
They would, but they wouldn't. Their attention wouldn't be on you. Still,
it'd be on the phone.
Find the phone.
It'd be on the cracked screen.
Make a clean getaway. Yeah. Anyway, I was going somewhere with this, which is that people. It seems to me that people, and it's going to the subject that you've been addressing lately, that people are using technology as a means unconsciously to not experience their interconnectivity, because they're experiencing this surrogate, this counterfeit way of being connected. So they're being connected to people all over the world, perhaps through their texts and all the rest of it, but they're becoming less and less connected to their actual physical environment.
Well, that's exactly what they're doing in their mind before they had these electronic ways of communicating. Connecting to people through movies is safer than going out on the street. You can watch Taxi Driver, or you can go back to New York in the 1970s and see how you'd fare, right?
You can't actually, but...
Yeah. Oh, God! Ah, what? Huh. You must be really
New York
awake.
People are nostalgic for that New York I think.
Yeah, I bet they are. They could do a mock-up, couldn't
up.
They? They could do an actual mock-up in New York on the same streets.
Because Travis finds he can't actually live without that. You know, he couldn't live in the cleaned-up New York. He'd be nostalgic too.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know that, but it makes sense. It makes sense. I mean, when I go over to another country that's not far from here, and I go to their city, they have a lot more old buildings, some of them are historical, and some of them are just crumbling down. And the smell of that just reminds me of my own upbringing, and it gives me some variety, like, you know, buildings that actually crumble and fall down. You don't find that around here anymore.
Hmm.
You know, buildings don't get old, diseased, and die. It's like the Buddha. They're like the Buddha of architecture around here. Buildings don't die.
Well, so that's probably why they're so drawn to technology and movies. Movie stars don't get old.
That's right.
And technology, of course, it does get obsolete. But I mean, if you're experiencing the world more and more virtually.
No, but you're experiencing the platform of the technology. The thing is that you keep upgrading your technology because you want it to become more vivid, more real time, more real. So it's going to become as fast as life. I mean, the problem is it's not as real as life yet. I mean, you're playing a Pac-Man game that isn't, you know, unless you're really into nostalgic retro 16-bit color and pixelation, which a few people are, because that's what that's their first exposure to the addiction of video games. But what most people want is lifelike real-time video games. That's what they want. They want it to be as real as life and more fantastic than life.
Okay, there ends part two of my conversation with Dave O'Shana, who is in Portland, Maine, this week, starting Wednesday the 26th. Part three will be up this coming Saturday, the 29th September, and the final part will be up on Wednesday the 3rd of October. This is Jason Horsley for The Liminalist, the podcast between. Please support this project by donating in the sidebar at the website via PayPal, or by buying one or more of my recent books, Prisoner of Infinity, Dark Oasis, Seen and Not Seen, or Paper Tiger. Thanks for listening. Until next time, have a wonderful